Thank you, Ben. So this is a very interesting collaboration. We are five people, everyone from a different place. So that's pretty funny. And how we meet, it's also even funnier. I just sent an email to Ben and he was interested, so we start to talk. So I wrote here, molecules are fun. Yeah, of course, because I do molecules, so then it has to be fun, otherwise I would be very stupid, right? So what I'm going to try is still to go directly to the talk by itself. I would like to give you like kind of a very stupid or brief introduction about what is molecule, right? At least very fundamental. Because if I ask you what is a molecule, what do you have in mind? What is a molecule? What's a molecule, right? I mean, what? I don't know. What do you have in mind? If I ask you what is a molecule, what comes to your mind?
Protons and neutrons.
What? Protons and neutrons. Protons and neutrons are molecules. Interesting. Interesting point of view.
Neutrons, electrons, all kind of bound together.
Those are so is an atom, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, no, that the reason why I'm asking that is because you guys are used, when you look at the atoms or whatever, usually you have the nuclei, you have the electrons, usually you guys go here and do all the business, right? In my case, this is so hard for me and so stupid, so I have to do something simple. So usually how it works is molecules. So molecules happen, occur, I mean, we are, thanks to molecules, we are alive. Otherwise, we cannot be here talking about high energy physics. So if we think like two atoms like this, one big one, and smaller one, what happens is a molecule is when the electrons of this guy and that guy start to interact. And then suddenly, they like to share a little bit of the orbits, and finally, they have kind of a bound state. The bound state is between the nuclei. But the guy that bound the molecules is the electrons. So all the molecular physics, all the chemistry is QED, as you know very well. So with QED is the most important part for study chemistry, biology, and many other things. Okay, this is a very nice picture. Now, the way how we treat this more, I'd say, more realistically, is let's assume that we have a complicated molecule, you know, many nuclei, and then with a bunch of electrons over there, right? So now, in 1927, I believe, von Oppenheimer proposed something like, we use this every day, the von Oppenheimer approximation. So what they realized is if you have a molecule, if you have nuclei that are very heavy and electrons that are very, very, they are very fast. Then you have two different motions: something slow, something fast. And it's interesting. Have you ever experienced what happens when you are in a plane and you are going to land in an airport close to the sea? Have you ever watched to the waves? What happened? Do it. It's like they don't move at all. It's like you are taking pictures. Like, and then I feel like an electron in a molecule. Because you are going too fast and the waves are going too slow. So it's like the waves, when you are looking at the waves from the plane, is like your nucleons and you are the electron. So this is what happened in the Oppenheimer approximation. The electrons move so fast that they feel that the nuclei are just fixed. So then it's like they don't do all the business and the nuclei are fixed. So that's the key point. These guys realize and they say, well, the wave function then for my molecule, if I assume that this is for all the electronic coordinates, all the electrons of my molecule, doesn't matter how big it is, how complicated it is, and this big R is the position of the nuclei, right? So they realize, well, then we can break this, or we can express this wave function. It's called the adiabatic approximation also. Like a wave function that depends on the nuclear degrees of freedom, like an electronic wave function that depends. Sorry. So this seems like kind of a stupid thing. Like, okay, sure. Yeah, but this simplifies your life a lot. Because what it's telling you is like the electronic energy, this guy here, R, is just a parameter. So what you do when you go to do quantum chemistry calculations or kind of electronic structure calculation, that we need to understand how the levels of molecules behave and stuff, the only thing that you do is you fix your atoms in a given geometry, and then you see how the electrons, what is the energy of the electrons. And then what you assume is if you look at this molecule, right, you will say, okay, where is the Hamiltonian? So, well, Hamiltonian, we have the kinetic energy of the electrons, of course, guys are moving, kinetic energy of the nuclei, then we have interaction between electrons, interaction between electrons and nuclei, and interaction between nuclei and nuclei, right? That's it. This is typical QED thing. I mean, we have Feynman diagrams and that kind of, that's so hard for us, okay? So we are just simple people. Then, what this guy realized is, in all this Hamiltonian, you can break down, the only guy that is really messing up with you is this guy here. He's the only guy that is totally independent of the electrons. So, and this is just like an overall factor. It's like kind of shift of the energy that depends on the distance of the nuclei. So it's just a zero energy point if you want to think it that way. So that's fine. So then this guy realized, well, if we now call these guys the electronic Hamiltonian, what happened is you can see that these guys called the electronic Hamiltonian is acting over this guy, give you is an eigenstate. This wave function is an eigenfunction of the electronic Hamiltonian. So what it means is, as I said before, sorry for my handwriting, is pretty bad. Is I hope it's pretty bad. Is all the electrons, the only thing that I'm giving you is what is the energy for a given geometry. So once you know that, then you come back to your Hamiltonian and solve this very simple, well, very simple. I mean, it's not simple. It depends how many nuclei you have. But how, this is how we build and how we calculate the electronic structure calculation for all kind of models. Of course, this is a very nice picture, general picture. When you try to work in a real world, things get complicated, but we find a way to understand a little bit better and find always a solution. So this is how simple it is a molecule. So always the trick is you separate electron degrees of freedom and nuclear degrees of freedom. Of course, sometimes this approximation doesn't work. For instance, one very particular system where it doesn't work is in positronium. Because in positronium, the nuclei is a positron. We want to think like a nuclei is a positron. And there is an electron, so they are equally heavy. So then they move equally fast. So all this does not apply. Then you have to solve the many body Schrödinger equation. And this is a very interesting.
Please. Have people built big molecules out of positronium?
Well, the biggest that can exist is deep positronium. That was predicted by John Wheeler in 1947, I believe, and was found in 2006.
Oh.
Yeah, indeed, it's people are working in deep positronium. But I think that the trimer is not bound, I think. So that's more or less the kind of introduction I wanted to give you about electrons and nuclei, right? So as I say, the electrons give you kind of the energy landscape where the nuclei are going to move, right? So now is when dark matter and molecules can be interesting. Because here we are going to assume that only dark matter is going to mess up with all nuclei, not with the electrons. That's a different business, a pretty hard one, but we are thinking about it and see how we can solve it. So the idea is, as I say, at the end you have this kinetic term plus some kind of potential energy coming from your, and then acting over nuclear wave function that has to give you an energy of the molecule, right? That's it. So then what is interesting about molecules, different from atoms, is this guy has internal degrees of freedom. So when you break this kinetic energy, you have a radial component and an angular component, right? The angular component gives you the rotation of the molecule, and the radial component gives you the vibration of the molecule. So this potential usually, I mean, you go to a textbook, they will say, oh, okay, usually it's a van der Waals potential that looks like that, right? That's a Morse potential, there are many kinds of different potentials that we use. So this is our U of R, our potential. And if we calculate the bound states using this guy, then we have the vibrational states, and on top of that, we have the rotational states over here. That's how it works. So usually, to give you kind of a see how these energies are, for H2, the energy spacing is around 0.5 eV for vibration. And for rotation, the rotational constant is 60 wave numbers. I don't know how to put that in. Okay, so kind of 10 to minus 2 eV, something like that, for rotation. Okay, so this guy is pretty small compared with the rotation. So usually how it works is electrons are fast. Then you go to the internal degrees of freedom. We have vibration and rotation. Vibration are slow. Rotation is pretty fast. So that's how it works. So there is a branch in chemistry called femtochemistry, where people use super fast lasers to understand how chemical reactions happen, how you have the arrangement of the electrons on different nuclei and stuff like that. And then that is why you have to be so fast, otherwise you don't see nothing. So saying that, this is just, I suppose that you know everything about molecules. So now I can move on to the talk. So now I can ask you whatever question about molecules that you will know the answer, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Well, of course not. Molecules are, can be very complicated. So, of course, I have to show this. This is where I don't know so much. So people like Ruben, Harry, and the experts on the field, they help me how to understand why this thing is important. So it seems that you guys come up with a model every day. So you wake up, you come with a model, it works fine. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. In molecules, you cannot do that because QED is there and there's nothing that you can do. But interesting that talking with Ben, he mentioned, and the reason why we start talking about this is because if you have something like a general system, doesn't matter if it's a molecule or whatever you can imagine, that the energy spacing or typical energy spacing is around 1 eV or so, you can cover this energy, this mass range. That seems to be very interesting for dark matter detection, since I noticed that WIMS doesn't work too much. So people don't like these guys anymore, right? So now we are more in this. This is what I heard from you, right? I don't know. I mean, I read a little bit about WIMS. Seems to be the best. Now it's the worst, so that's fine. And also, some other people are trying to do this QCD. This is very nice, by the way. This is very interesting stuff. And also, I think that molecules can be useful there if you couple with photonic devices and stuff like that. But that's also something that we are thinking on. So this is a wonderful paper by Ren, Mardon, and Ambransky, where they have this very interesting equation just to see why molecules are interesting. Because if we have an energy spacing, typically 1 eV, as I say, it turns out that the typical mass that you can explore is an eV. And that's pretty interesting, because this is a mass that maybe you cannot reach with these experiments with accelerators and stuff like that, because you have too much energy. And that's kind of the thing that we gain. So what we are going to do in this talk is just focus on vibrational excitation of molecules and see if that can be useful for dark matter detection. So this is our approach, pretty simple one. Well, it looks simple, right? So the idea is, imagine that we have a tank. Of course, you have to imagine a lot, of course. So we have a tank with molecules and atoms, right? So in this case, the atom that we are going to choose is helium, because helium is always the best, doesn't like to mess up too much. It's very nice. And the molecule that we're going to choose, in our case, is going to be CO, but I'm going to talk about different molecules. So this is the whole story. So what happens is, imagine that a dark matter collides with a molecule, right? If all molecules are in the ground state, because we prepare everything in the ground state, controlling temperature, pressure, and all the different things, then we believe that if we find a molecule that is excited, it's because that matter is messing up with our molecules, right? That's our assumption. Okay, anything that is pretty good one, but of course I'm the author, so it doesn't make so much sense. So let's assume that happens, right? So what we assume is when that matter collides with the molecule gets excited to the V equal 2 state. So we are going to the ground state, to the V equal 2. So here, this one intermediate state, this guy here, we go up, okay? So then turns out that when this molecule in the V equal 2 state collides with a ground state molecule, because only one is excited, the rest are in the ground state because dark matter doesn't seem to collide too much with regular things. So then what happened is there is a resonant collision where the energy going down and up is the same. So it's a very effective process. So very fast, these guys go to two molecules in the V equal 1 state. And then these guys decay to the ground state emitting a photon. And hopefully we will detect those photons in our photon detectors. The good thing...
I need to interrupt you. Okay, so an E, what happens between D and E again?
Between D and E? Yeah. So these guys collide?
Yes.
All right. So these guys de-excite and these guys get excited.
But to a different level, it's intermediate. Is that...
No, the intermediate level is the same. This is from V equal 2 to V equal 1. From V equals 0 to V equals 1.
That's what I need to hear. V equals 2. So yes. you started at a vibration where n equals 2.
Right? Yeah, n equals 2, yeah.
And then they go, okay, that's the step that I somehow didn't
so, say. And what forbids a V equals 2 to the ground state, the excitation via photon, or say, the time scales are very different?
Let's see. So the spontaneous emission rate for these guys usually is around 10 seconds. Okay. This collision is super fast. It's like 1,000 times faster. So that isn't why we choose this guy in particular.
And incidentally, just to orient myself and also because of some of the audience, does anything change in your story if your background is xenon instead of helium?
Yeah. The collisional properties will change. Okay. As I'm going to explain, that's a very good question because if you change the guy, what happened is, because I didn't put it here, right? So here it seems like, okay, every time that you have one V equal one state, is going to go to a ground state. That's not true. You can also decay through a collision with another guy.
But presumably the coupling to translation, you know, if you have a diatomic molecule in monatomic xenon or whatever, you know, the argon or whatever, then coupling the vibration into a, kicking a vibration into an initial state, vibration and a xenon, final state, no vibration, and a screaming xenon atom sounds like, I don't know, doesn't sound very probable, but maybe it happens.
Well, I will show you some results. I also was thinking that way, and then when we look at the data, I said, well, maybe we should take care about what is the guy that you put there.
Okay.
So, yeah, but in principle, you're right. Yeah.
There's also another version of this, which is it's slightly different because, in liquid xenon, when we actually the scintillation we detect comes from a molecule itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's an excimer sort of molecule where one xenon is excited and one is in a ground state. But it's all the same stuff.
Okay? Yeah. It's...
But getting there is a different process.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we understand that process that well. We just look for the light. How we get the light, no one really knows.
Well, if you don't care, then you are fine. No.
Yeah. Well, but there's an idea out there in the xenon world to detect the infrared. As the excited molecule excimer hits the ground state xenon, they vibrate a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people in the world who have detected that infrared. And it's an ongoing question in the liquid xenon detectors. Could we put in infrared detectors and see the initial...
Something that I always... I'm very impressed about xenon and all these liquid detectors is... Because you say when we do all these things, everything's in gas phase.
Right.
And I don't know how that changed in liquid phase, because usually the techniques has to change.
Maybe they don't live long enough to detect.
So yeah, so that's always my concern with the liquid phase. I'm always scared of liquid phase. It's so hard for me. It's like, this is all gas phase, of course.
Understood. Yeah, I agree with you, by the way.
Liquid phase, this will be a hard problem for me to solve.
Okay.
But yeah, please.
Why is this carried to V equals 2 and not just V equals 1 or V equals 3?
We can go to V equals 3, V equals 4, V equals 20.
It scatters to a random vibrational state and then through collisions all fall down into V equals 1 first.
Yeah, so we also are thinking going to 3, 4 and have several photon detection too, because it seems, I'm not an expert, but Ruben told me that if we have coincidence measurement, then you don't have to worry about the dark counts. And since the dark count is always the problem for you guys, I mean, when you want to detect single photon, it's always a problem. And it turns out that these photons has a very low energy for a typical photon detector, because I know that in xenon or whatever is 70 eV or something like that, here we are talking about, I will say, 0.25 eV.
Yeah.
So that's a problem for you guys. So then Ruben was saying, well, if you have something that can have a different, like we have a coincidence measurement, like with 2, 3, 4 photons, then we have kind of a spectrum, and then we can forget about dark counts. So it can be easier. So in principle, yeah, we can go to 3, 4, and so on. The thing is, if you go also to higher resonance states, remember that the energy gap that you are going to explore is bigger, so then you are exploring bigger and bigger masses too. So that's always the trade-off. But It will not change so much, so yeah, you're right, we can go there.
How fast is the decay from the first level down?
From here to there, the spontaneous emission rate is 32.5 seconds minus 1. So it's like 10 milliseconds or so, it will decay.
What energy are you talking about?
The energy here is 0.25 eV, similar to that.
See, because of unharmonicity, it will be off resonance.
Well, of course. I mean, I'm assuming here the simplistic thing, right, that it's harmonic, but no, when we do like the simulation, we have the numerical potential, and we solve the Schrödinger equation with a number of methods. So yeah, you're right, there is an harmonicity, and there is not exactly twice or three times the omega, for sure, you're right. But we have that into account. Please.
So like, how hard is it practically to set up a gaseous bath of helium and CO2 such that, or the CO, so that it's all in the ground state? Sitting there waiting to be. I have no feeling for how hard it is to get things in their ground state.
Preparing the ground state is just temperature going down. So at 40 Kelvin, for instance, we know that you have like a gram or 10 grams of CO, everything is going to be in the equal CO state. No way that one guy is going to be in the equal one state.
Okay.
For instance, that's for the vibration. Rotation is a different business because rotation, as I say, is small energy scale, so then you're going to populate like 10 or so.
Sure.
But in our case, we are not taking care of that. So yeah, in principle, it's just a temperature thing.
Yeah.
Also, I would discuss black body radiation that mess up a lot with us.
Right, yeah.
That's also a problem that we have, but we found a way. Because the black body radiation that we are talking about is what happened about the things that are surrounding your experiment. So everything around your gas is at a given temperature, so that can emit photons, and those photons can mess up with your molecules. And that's what we are going to discuss too. Any more questions?
Why is I'm missing something. Why is in E, why is the repeated
plus? No problem, man. That's fine. So the idea is this guy collides, we have a certain molecule in the V equal 2. Then one V equal 2 molecule collides with a V equal 0. As a final state, we have two V equal 1 molecules. This is resonant decay thing, or I don't know what it's called.
In the lifetime of V equals 2, you said was. How?
Yeah, it's like kind of similar to this guy. It's like kind of 10 second minus one, something like that, usually.
10 seconds.
Yeah, that doesn't change so much. So, but this process is pretty fast.
Okay.
This, for CO, at least, it's pretty, pretty, pretty fast.
V over 2 doesn't decay due to Frank-Condon factor.
They have
decay.
From 2 to 0, it decays. Because it has a permanent dipole moment, so you can decay always.
But maybe small Frank-Condon factor or something, why it doesn't decay straight
away? You're right. Because, yeah, the Frank-Condon factor is smaller between 0 and 2 and the 1 and 2. Yeah.
One is much better because of the.
One is way better, but it changes like less than order of magnitude. That's what I'm saying. It changed like maybe 50% or so. That's what it changed. That's what we found. It changed, but doesn't change like 100 times better. So this is faster than this guy. This guy is lower. But we always want is this guy has to win to decay of this guy, and it does. It does.
Sorry, the decay on the right, is that's not spontaneous decay, or it's collisional excitation?
This one?
No, the one on the right.
This is spontaneous.
That's spontaneous. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is, yeah, because we need to detect photons.
Right.
So we want to control that collision doesn't mess up with our states. And collisions are always there. So.
But for excitation, does Frank-Condon factor matter? And you need to excite V equal to 2 by that matter. Yeah?
Yeah, well, we calculate.
Small overlap of ground and excitation.
Yes. Well, we
reduces probability.
Yeah, we calculate the form factors for that. Yeah. In order to, at the end of the talk, I will show the final results that really matter for you guys. That's pretty sad. But at the end, I will show you the sigma n, the cross section for n as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle that we are exploring. And in that calculation, we take into account the Frank-Condon factor. The form factors coming between V equals 0 and V equals 2 state. Yeah. We take that into account. And also, we did it also for 0.1, 0.3, 0.4. We have all that information. So the form factor includes the Frank-Condon factor, if you want to think it that way. Okay, let's keep going. So this was just kind of the very first slide. Fun. I'm happy. So it seems simple, but always we have to take care of many things. One is, as I say, spontaneous emission rate is one of the things that we have to take care of. Thermal population, observational states, we need to put all the guys in the ground state, otherwise problems. Black body radiation, always a very good friend. Collision at the excitation. And then the last point, the bonus, photon absorption. Also, photons can be absorbed. So we can always have problems with that. And it's always something that we have to think about. So It's a simple idea, but we have to take into account so many parameters that everything, in order to work, or we hope to work, of course. So, first of all, I would like to discuss why we choose heteronuclear against homonuclear. Because, for instance, at the very beginning when we started to talk, we were thinking about H2, because H2 has a omega of 0.5 eV. H2 is a very well-known molecule, has good collisional properties, but the problem is it doesn't have a permanent dipole moment. So then it means that the lifetime of this guy is super long. And you cannot wait too long to have a photon. You will get bored, right? So we don't want that. We want something faster. And faster is heteronuclear, because heteronuclear has permanent dipole moments, and then you don't have transition between the resonant state without going to the quadrupole moment. This is an E1 allowed transition. This is an E2 allowed transition. So that's the difference in the order of magnitude. So that's just for saying that we want heteronuclear. But if you do heteronuclear, then we have to pay a price always. Having a permanent dipole moment induces faster collisional decay rate because the interaction is more anisotropic, so then the guys to collide better. And of course, we have blackbody radiation. In H2, we don't have that problem. That's the good thing about homonuclear. Blackbody radiation doesn't mess up with you because you don't have permanent dipole moment. So the same thing that mess up with you here help you in the blackbody radiation. But finally, we decide to move to the heteronuclear case. So, but still, that's something that we can explore over there. We believe that we are working on that and see if we can do something nice. So, please.
I imagine some tiny, tiny change, but somewhere in between those two cases, you could have like HD.
We give HD. You're right. We tried HD. That has a very small dipole moment, the smallest.
Yeah.
But it order changed like 2 orders of magnitude or 3.
Okay.
So
right.
Still is yeah. But yeah, you're right. And also we tried even HT. That's even weird with the tritium and still, yeah, HT. But because it doesn't matter if it's radioactive or something, we don't care, right? Although I'm not going to do the experiment. I will be fine. So. Yeah, you're right. HD should work better, but still we prefer to go something like CO or HF and something like a decent dipole moment. Okay, that's how you put so many fancy things. Okay, so second point is the thermal population, right? So now we decide we want to do heteronuclear because otherwise we are in a bad position. So this is the vibrational partition function, right? Assuming a harmonic oscillator, typical exercise, I don't know that you do in high school or whatever, I don't know. Maybe high school, no, maybe in first year college or whatever. So you can calculate what is the probability to get the guys in a given vibrational state. And if you do that, you pick your favorite molecule, you put here your omega, and then you see what the temperature that you need to put there in order to be sure that everything has to be in the ground state. And then it turns out that we need low temperatures, that's for sure. And the bad thing is lower pressure also means low. Low temperatures means low pressure. Low pressure means low densities. Low densities means bigger things, and everything gets complicated. So we need to take care of that. Then the blackbody radiation. So here is the transitional dipole moment between the initial state and the final state where we are going, and this is the typical expression that I found that molecular physicists we use, but other people use a different one. Why there is a debate between surface emission or volume emission? I use this one. I'm a molecular physicist. I'm happy with that. So this is the dipole metric element, as I say. This is the vibrational frequency. And of course, the temperature matters. But this temperature is the temperature of the things surrounding you, right? Because at the end, what you have here is the typical Planck distribution, right? So as a function of the temperature, you can have more photons with a given frequency, right? So this is the trade that we need to find, what is the right temperature. And then it means looking at here that in order to avoid this, we need things with small dipole moment. So then HD will be good for us, for that thing again, but the A will be bad. So still, we believe that CO can be better. And of course, the most important thing is we need this guy to be big. The bigger it is, the probability radiation miss almost nothing. So we need a small type of moment and low temperature, of course. So this is an example of some guys that we choose. I didn't put here HD. Sorry. So we have water. We're not doing water, but just to, we did that just for fun. Because if you have a polyatomic system, then you have many different ways to excite the system. In a diatomic case, you only have one way, the guys are vibrating, right? But if you have water, you have three different vibrational modes. Each of them have different energy. So then your dark matter have more probability. You know, it has like three choices to excite. It can be interesting. The problem is how to calculate that in terms of form factors doesn't seem to be very easy. So we forget about that and we get into these guys, right? So CO is going to be your best guy. Also, we work with HCl. And this is how it looks like. This is the spontaneous the absorption rate for CO and HCl for the blackbody radiation. And what is important here is that we need to go at very low temperatures in order to be sure that these guys go beyond. I mean, we have less than one event. Because otherwise, the thing is, the blackbody radiation is going to excite our molecules and it's going to mess up with us. So,
events per year per molecule?
No, so this is events per year, assuming what's 10 grams of molecules? 10 grams of molecules, we did that. And finally, collision at the excitation. So this is 0, this is 2, I believe. No, no, this is 0.1, sorry, 0.1. Yeah, and this is what he was asking me. So here, I don't know if you can see it. Sorry, it's a very old paper. So these guys in the 60s, they made a lot of measurements of different vibrational times. I mean, CO in helium, CO in argon, CO in CO, CO in H2. I don't know. They had a bunch of data, right? But the problem we look here is always the temperature. We cannot go, you know, 300 Kelvin. So at that time, because usually if you are a chemist, of course, you're interested in room temperature things, or higher, never lower. So I understand why they did that. So the thing is, looking at here, you can learn about CO in argon, CO in helium. CO in helium works very good, and CO in argon also works very good. So we can use argon too, if we want to, for instance. So maybe it can be useful too. So these guys come up with this expression here to fit all this data. This is based on the Landau-Teller model. It's a very old model that's supposed to work only for high-energy collisions. When I say high-energy, it's 100 eV or more, or something like that, not your high-energy, right? So, and it's, in our case, we choose CO for this reason, because CO seems to have a very nice collisional property with other gases, so, and CO has a good potassium emission rate, so we are fine. CO is a great candidate, we believe, of course. So then we can calculate the same for CO, and we can see that we need to go to 40 Kelvin in order to be sure that we don't have any black body radiation event that can mess up again inside the molecule to the state that we are looking into. So we need to keep everything cool down at 40 Kelvin. Otherwise, problems. So CO at 40 Kelvin. Also, at 40 Kelvin, it's interesting because all the variational population is going to be in the V equals zero state. But as I say, the rotationals, no. At, for instance, this is 30 Kelvin or 40 Kelvin, for instance, we have all these guys that are populated, as you can see. So all these guys has to be taken into account when we do all the form factor calculation. So now, yeah. The bonus is always the worst. So, okay, now we have controlled collisions. We know almost everything, but now, let's say we emit the photon. Now the photon gets absorbed, we are done. We kill ourselves or something like that. So, the absorption cross-section is defined this way with this H bar omega is the energy of the photon, right, that it's emitted. This is the absorption coefficient or the B-Einstein coefficient. And this G omega is just the profile of your excitation. That depends in your case of collision, where this sigma L is the elastic collision rate between CO and helium. Okay? So by doing so, we put all these numbers, put it together, take into account what is the relation between the B factor and the A that it tells you that is 32.5 seconds minus 1. The wavelength for the photon that we are looking at is 4.6 microns. is the wavelength. So you put all the numbers, and then we get the this. So we get the absorption cross section and the mean free path for, of course, this is on resonance and resonance, and then what happens when you are kind of far of, off resonance. So if we choose, the thing is the trick, since we have helium and CO, it's funny, but if you have a gas, molecular gas, and you put it in contact with a high dense helium gas or another gas that is more or less inert, I mean, that doesn't play too much role in the collision. What happens is you enhance the mean free path due to the collisions that are messing up with your photon, with your absorbers or emitters all the time. And if we go to a partial pressure of 5 × 10⁻⁵ bar for CO, but a pressure of almost 1 bar for helium, then we get these numbers, and this is like 1.4 meters. So it's like a photon can travel like more than 1 meter without being absorbed. So that gives you what is the size of the tank that you can use. Because if you use a bigger tank, yeah, the problem is you have this 3D Brownian motion, because it can get absorbed, then it's emitted, then it's emitted in a random position, in a random direction, see how long it takes, all that stuff. So in our case, we went to a more easy approach, so please.
Can you explain again what role is the helium playing?
So, mean free path is the density of CO times the absorption cross section.
The mean free path of the excited
photon.
Not the photon.
Okay. Or the photon. So it's how long can travel the photon because it before it gets absorbed, right? So this is the density of CO that we can control through the partial pressure. And here, what we have here, this G omega depends on the density of helium. So if this guy is if we increase density of helium, we can make this guy smaller. And then the mean free path can be bigger, and we can go to up to 1.4 meters. That's what we do. So the thing is, if you have CO, pure CO, the mean free path is going to be 5 × 10⁵ bigger. Sorry, smaller. So the thing is, if we make the gas more dilute, it's better for. Sorry, I didn't see you.
That's okay. Is the helium pressure broadening the line? Is that what it's doing?
Yeah. Well. Let me be precise on that. Let's see. So this elastic collision here that is causing the broadening of the line is the elastic collision between helium and CO. So if we increase the density of helium, we make the cross-section, or the rate in this case, or bigger.
So it's pressure broadening.
Yes. Okay. Elastic one. And we are not doing elastic here.
Let me ask, you could just operate the 10⁻⁵ bar.
Yeah.
And but it's like you want to make it so experimentalists don't have to build a pressure vessel. You want to keep it at 1 bar.
So
is that the idea?
No, the idea is, because if we put it that small pressure, you need a super big tank.
Because you have to build a structurally a vacuum tank. Basically.
But in this case, what happened is, due to this enhancement factor, the thing is, if you have pure CO, so the guy here is going to be the elastic collision of CO with CO. Because you have only CO.
So it's narrower then?
Yeah.
Okay, it's narrower.
Yeah, and then mess up with you.
Okay.
So what you need is something that is going to broaden the...
Yeah. We used to sometimes call helium, it's like vacuum with pressure. That's what we're using helium, but you're also using a line broadening.
Yeah, but here the way is like helium is has a huge density compared with CO. Yeah. So we used to broaden everything and...
The other trick that's used, but maybe you know this trick, is the way scintillators work, is the energy is transferred to a less... abundant molecule, and then that molecule has such low abundance that it doesn't self-absorb. Mm. You know, plain old plastic scintillator is actually quite complicated in this respect. There is and sometimes there's even a second molecule, which is a wave shifter molecule. But so it's scintillator has exactly the same problem that you have of self-absorption, and there's these techniques that evolve to evade the self-absorption, adding this impurity molecule whose whole job is to collisionally transfer the excitation and re-emit it.
Then it will propagate.
Yeah.
So, but here, since we are in gas phase.
I know. It's just an idea that.
That's very good.
Ideas. It's a very common experimental idea to do wave shifting. I don't know if you need a world you wave shift a lot.
Well, I just want, okay, I wanted to just follow up on what Harry said, or I was thinking about, and then I have another question. So along these lines, potentially you could, I don't know how this would work, but you could potentially have H2, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you could have something else in there that could collide with H2. So H2 is not going to get black body excited or something like this, and then you could
pick up this excitation.
And you might evade the whole delta, the quadrupole transition. You know, there's this ultimately huge lifetime of homonuclear excitations.
Yes.
Can I say homonuclear? Okay, homonuclear, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, is that the right word? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, same principle, you could have a trace additive whose whole job in life was to take the excitation of the homonuclear molecule and transfer it to one, to another one. Just another idea.
So you are saying the dark matter excites hydrogen transfer the through collision and excitation to CO or something, and then you see that photon.
Experimentalists wouldn't bat an eyelid at that. If you just said it, we'd go, oh, okay.
But along those lines, the thing I should have asked earlier is, you're assuming we're going to have some excitation of V equals 2, then V equals 2 is going to collide, and you're going to get 2 V equals 1 guys, and then we're going to detect those two photons. Why is that important? Why is it important to go to the, to have those two guys in V equals 1 and detect that light, rather than the V equals 2 to 0 light?
The thing is, if you go to the V equal 2 and you are waiting just for the photon to come up, the thing is, the collision of the excitation is so fast. This is it's super fast. Because I can write back here. There's something.
Why not go to the V equal 1 state directly?
Yeah. I don't. Okay, so you end up in V equals 2. Somehow you need to detect that.
The thing is, we have, let's say you have CO in 1 colliding, sorry, in 2.
Yeah.
Colliding with CO in 0, right? So if you have that collision, in principle, you don't go to 0, 0, of course, that's on channel. But the thing is, if you look at the energy levels of CO, the vibrational states, the anharmonicity is pretty small. So then it turns out that any difference from this guy and that guy is the same, more or less. So then you have this resonant thing that makes this process super fast compared with the 2 to 0.
So are you just saying that this process, this last step E, it's kind of almost parasitic, and it's just going to happen?
Yeah, okay. It will happen.
This is very similar to the way, we would call the floors. The floor is the first scintillator and the scintillator. But here you're just getting to something that can emit a photon, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
your process here.
Yes.
But you could also go to a non-CO2 or CO molecule, and then that photon might pop.
Yes.
That's the advantage of that.
Actually, so yeah, we're thinking also lately to put different molecules and see what happens. But yeah, that's something that we are looking at. But also, the problem is, for instance, if you have a different molecule like HF or HCl, it turns out that HF or CO has a very small dipole moment. The moment that you have something with a bigger dipole moment, it's going to mess up these things and it will make it harder. That's our feeling. And there's no any experimental data at low temperature. So I would be happy if someone of you can do the experiment. I would be very happy. Other data, please.
So there's a trick by which you can acquire a transition with a laser. That is to say, if the transition has happened, the laser pumps up to a high state, and
the
then you just have to see the transition back down.
Yes.
Which is a
the RIMPy thing.
You consider that?
Yes, we tried that. Indeed, that was our first way to go. And then we found something that I was close to kill myself. So what happened with the RIMPy? RIMPy is a very typical technique in AMO physics. What people do there is you have something in, I will explain to you, because it's a very interesting technique and very well understood. But the thing is, usually, let's assume that you have your ground state, you have intermediate state, and then you have the continuum, right? So what RIMPy does is, you have a two-photon process, usually. Well, within the photon, is pretty hard. So what happens is you go from here to there, and then from here to the continuum, right? So then, if you have a molecule in the vibrational state, you form an ion. Okay, you ionize the molecule. But if you are in the vibrational one, you don't. Okay? That works for ultra-cold physics, where I come from, where you have another 10 to the 12 molecules, or 10 to the 10, and then you can see that. But it's called the Raman effect. Raman effect, it turns out that the absorption cross section that I just plotted, you pick the frequency of the photon, the energy shift between these two guys is not enough. Because the thing is, you need a high intensity laser. So all these photons are going to mess you up, and you're going to have signal from here. When you do AIMO experiments, you don't care about that, you're fine. Because this is, I mean, you don't see anything. But if you are thinking to see, I don't know, 1,000 events per year, this will kill you. So the reason why we are not doing REMPI, that technique, is because Raman will kill us. But there is something that we are thinking of that is going to EIT state. Electromagnetic induced transparency, dark state. Someone of you know what is that? Something funny from quantum optics. So what you do is you induce an interference between two states, and you make your system transparent to a photon. So for instance, if I have, let's say, typical, I don't know, three-level scheme, right? So the thing is, if you have a photon that is resonant with this guy, right, you want to go the photon through. It's going to be absorbed. But you put a laser here and there, they interfere, and then this guy is going to be transferring to this photon. But you have to control the timing and the phase of the laser. And then you create a superposition that is called dark state. And people have proven that for ionization, for atoms. And it should work for molecules. So if we find a way to apply this technique here, then this will be the best way to go, for sure. Because lasers are way easier to, you know, to control and design. So we're thinking about that, using dark state technology to make interference and then go to REMPI. But REMPI by itself, it's hard. It's going to work. Please.
Does the pressure broadening from the helium reduce the absorption cross section, the dark matter absorption cross section?
The dark matter absorption cross section.
So the dark matter is not being absorbed, right? It's just scattering.
That's true, but I'm.
Sorry, wait for ribosomic absorption.
I don't know about that.
So he would look at scattering.
I don't have an answer for that, to be honest.
So the two states going to the two ones, lighting going to the one states, is larger than the CO2 and the helium collision? CO and helium collision from the two states.
Well, yeah, they are. Yes, you're right.
Because of the resonance.
Yes. Okay. CO helium is way slower than CO for DV equal 2. Yes.
Because of the resonance.
Yes. Because helium does have internal structure. Well, it has, but the energy are so far away that you cannot transfer the energy into the internal states of helium. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason.
Okay. So does the collisional damping affect that rate?
No. The rate of helium is coming just from the properties of how helium and CO interact. So it's just a two-body thing. And the properties of CO and CO that give you the other cross-section.
This is the CO emission width.
OK, so now you're talking about the emission, not about the scattering. OK, so the elastic cross-section here they have is the collision between CO and helium. So you make this thing bigger, like you start to put more density, you make this guy smaller, right? So this guy is smaller. Then when you go here, this guy is bigger. So then the mean free path, let's see. Oh, okay, here you go. So we have the lambda of the photon. That's the first thing that we have to take care of. We put it there, and this is the density, right? But then there's a ratio between the density of CO and the density of the elastic cross-section of CO helium that depends on helium, not on CO. And then you have that fraction. That fraction gives you an enhancement. And that isn't why we prefer to dilute our CO in helium. But thinking about your question, I don't have an answer. We didn't think about that. So you are saying, or you believe, that the broadening coming from helium can mess up the collision with dark matter.
Well, it broadens all of the...
Yes, you're right. Yeah. So I think that's a fair point. Yeah, so you are saying... But in the formalism that we are using, do we take that into account?
Ruben? No, but I think we can just take into account that we change the cross section a little bit. We're not just thinking about
it. You're integrating over some response function for this resonant system.
Yeah. So, in the treatment of Ruben, we are not taking into account any width. Yeah. So maybe we should.
I'm just thinking because it's scattering, it's going to be not bad, but maybe it's... So this is where the dark matter disappears, right? It's absorbed by...
No,
it's
scattering.
Scattering.
For absorption, I think it would be a problem.
Scattering is more of a continuous spectrum.
That's what I'm saying. It's a good question.
But if you have a boson of mass exactly 0.1 eV, I don't know if that's impossible, you know, being an idiot. But you know, if it's like the way an axion disappears in a haloscope, if it's like totally disappearing, then it would be quasi resonant.
You're integrating shock resonance.
Exactly.
Just the total strength of it, doesn't that also go down? I think it goes down.
Well, usually that's
maybe it's a very small
factor. I think it's the way how we proceed is the other way around. It's like you calculate the cross section and the elastic, and the elastic cross section tells you what is the broadening.
Yeah.
That's what we do. So we calculate the cross section here, my first principles. You get that, then from that you calculate the broadening, and the broadening is where you go here. Sorry for this.
So that's for n equals 1.
Yeah, and for n equal 2 we do the same.
Okay.
It's always the same process. So how things work in how we build it is we have the cross section, then we calculate the rate, then we calculate the broadening. But usually we don't think about how broadening the cross section. It's the other way around. It's how the elastic and elastic cross section. Kind of. Indeed, that's one of the methods that people in AMO use to see properties of the interaction potential between atoms and molecules. They invert the results. Yeah. So, but that's something that, yeah, we should talk about that. You know, we didn't even think about that. Good point. Thank you. So finally, this plot. And at the end, still I have to talk about this. I thought I only have like one. Okay, so this is what I want to show you, some kind of numbers about how fast it is, CO in helium and CO with CO. So this is CO in CO, this is CO in helium, assuming the same pressure of 0.1 millibar, we are using half of that. And then the thing is we need to work in temperature where our decay is smaller than our spontaneous emission decay, right? Otherwise we are in a bad situation. And then we found something funny. Using the paper that I showed you from the 60s, you can extrapolate that to lower temperatures, assuming that is going to work. But we are happy because we don't need to do that, because thanks to my very good friend Roman Krems, he calculated quantum mechanically CO in helium up to 10 Kelvin. So we know from very first principles using a very good potential energy surface for CO in helium how it looks like CO helium collisions. And for COCO, what we do, we don't have any data. There's no any calculation, any experiment about COCO at those temperatures. So that's something I'm going to do, but that will take several months. So what we do instead is to take H2 with H2 as a test. And then use H2 as your COCO guy. And yeah, this is a deviation. And this is the process that we were talking about, the 2-0 into 1-1. And this rate is super fast. So a density is typical here, like 10 to the 16 centimeters cubed. So it's 10 to the 4. So it's super fast. So the photon doesn't have time to decay. Before it decays, it already goes to the V1, V1. So that's the reason why we choose CO in the V equal to state. Of course, this is a 75 Kelvin. That was the results were made. We are working at 40. Of course, we will expect a suppression of that. So maybe it's going to be like 1 or 2 orders of magnitude smaller. But still, you beat the photon emission. And finally, I will show the results someday. I don't know why I put this again. Sorry. Yeah, there you go. Finally, the results. So here what we have is assuming this is the sigma n, as I promised, a function of the mass of dark matter particle. And here is, this is assuming 1 gram. For 1 gram, we need to build a tank or vessel of 1.37 meters. That seems pretty hard to do right now, but maybe in 1,000 years it will not work. No, it will work soon. So we,
Yeah, that doesn't seem like hardware.
Really?
No, but how are you going to detect the photons?
Yeah.
The thing is...
That seems hard.
That's the hard part, right? I guess. Okay, so... In principle, the our idea is this guy is going to be covered by the photon detectors, right? So now the problem is, as I said before, it seems that the energy that we are looking at is very bad for photodetectors. So we have dark counts, all that stuff. So the thing is, I don't know what the current state of the technology. I know how people can make it. I know how good it can be. So in principle, if we can, since we have two photons now, we have a continuous measurement, we don't need to work to worry about dark counts, but still we need a high quantum efficiency. And I don't know if that exists right now. Right now, I think that the technology is not available for this wavelength, we believe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of development going on.
Yes.
About what a five-year time scale. Not
that's what I don't know. That's
what
Ruben is there.
But
they did a whole other square board, like to physically actually cover the entire thing.
You don't necessarily have to physically cover it. You could also use
a mirror or something like that.
You can focus it a little bit.
Yeah, you could put optical lenses on the
Right. Yeah. So, sorry, can you say more about the prospects for EIT detection? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I guess roughly I'm imagining you just have like a big long tube or something, right? And you're shining lasers.
That's right.
And you're
so
looking for
we imagine something pretty Star Trek thing, but due to the Raman thing, we never did. The idea is if you have a cylinder, you have a laser, you can use the same laser. If you have many cylinders, you can use mirrors.
Sure.
And then we have like many of them in the same place. So then, yeah, and the thing is, we ionize, and when we apply it, if this is the cylinder, because another problem that you have is when you have a ion, the ion can mess up, right? Because ions interact so strongly.
Okay, so you detect the ion.
Yes, we have an... Yes, so in our case, we don't care about photons. If we do RMP, we detect ions. And how we do it, we apply an electric field in this direction, the axial direction, and we cover this with MCP. This is a very easy technology and compared with the photon detector. And you will see, look guys, that would be the way to go. That's what we're thinking of.
This is where I don't know much about this. When you say EIT, what does that stand for?
What?
Excited intermediate
electromagnetic
induced transparency.
The same dark state.
Yeah, it's the idea of introducing an interference between two pathways.
I should have said dark state.
Yeah, but it's fine. But, I'm simple-minded on these things. You know, some way to excite based for only those that were in an excited state to begin with. Is that the sort of...
Yeah, you know, that's the goal.
It's boiled down to the simplest thing, that you somehow want to excite... You don't want to excite the ground state, you want to leave the ground state alone.
Right.
But if something gets excited, can you figure out a way to bang that up and recover the energy? Well, one way or the other, you're trying to add energy only if there's been an initial, much smaller excitation.
That's right.
And you're looking for ways to do that.
Yes.
And one way is REMP or whatever...
Resonance enhanced multiphoton ionization.
That's what that is.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So I wrote the two photons, you have three photons, depends on the molecule. Even you have single photon, but that's you need too much power there. So because the thing is, if you work with the right frequency of your laser, you are only resonant with one given state, right? So that's the idea. But due to the Raman effect, if we are looking about few events per year, that can mess up. Because usually in AMO experiments, they don't wait for 1 year. So you wait maybe for 1 week, 1 month at most, and something like that, or maybe that's too much.
A couple minutes.
Yeah. Usually it's pretty fast compared. So the thing is, have something stable for such a long time, you are going to accumulate a lot of background, and that's a problem. So if that idea, if we come up with a dark state thing, that I know that it works for ionization of atoms, have been proven, but I don't know, in principle, it should work also for molecules. As long as you find the right Frank quantum factor, that's a little bit more.
Yeah, this gets more complicated with the rotational levels.
But it will work.
Yeah.
In the same way that the what is the call that they make the coherent transfer that is working, that the guys are doing this with molecules.
Sure.
STIRAP, right? With the STIRAP. The STIRAP was proven in atoms, then they went to molecules and works. STIRAP is a coherent transfer population. It's a way that people come up with transfer all guys from one state to another with almost 80-90% efficiency. It's pretty good, but pretty hard to do in lab. So that also can work here, but again, it's a complicated business. Please.
What was the typical wavelength of the output that you were hunting for? Was it
4.6 microns?
4.6 microns.
Yeah, it's a bad wavelength. No one likes that. Even people in AMO don't like that. But people in astrophysics do love that. I noticed that. CO is a very important module for astrophysics. And they have developed a lot of different techniques to detect these guys. But of course, not at the level that we are aiming here. So we should talk with them.
Well, by the way, there's some people maybe in our department who sometimes think, is there any way astrophysical gas clouds themselves could be used as detectors?
Orin,
I don't know how, but there's an awful lot of mass is really hot.
About that.
Okay, there's already going to talk about this at
yeah.
the conference.
I didn't hear it. Okay.
Not the past one, the one like a month ago.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. No.
Using molecular.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so the idea is he had the same kind of idea, but in a molecular club, and it seems pretty nice.
Yeah. And Oren's coming back next week.
Okay. Good. No, I wasn't aware of that. Okay. And is the answer that there's some promising way?
It's challenging.
What's that?
It's challenging, I think, because of backgrounds. Okay. But yeah, I think people haven't observed it, I think, for very long as well. So I want to do that.
The other idea that someone sometimes has talked about is, you know, hydrogen, an example, has these, the two atoms, their relative alignment of their spins mm-hmm. can be either singlet or triplet.
Yeah.
And, you know, could there be a way to somehow exploit that? You know, that's the broad question. Is there any clever idea of, it could just be maybe statistically sampling the populations, and maybe the populations of them will give you a clue. I mean, do they deviate from a thermal population? Or, I don't know, but who knows how long it takes to thermalize. If you're all born in one state, how long does it take to bathe in the universe to get calibrated? I don't know. Okay, they're very basic questions. Well, I don't have any idea, but you sense that there could be something interesting, though, in a spin flip that has a very low energy, very low delta.
Yeah, also that we have been thinking on is maybe what happens if we use a strong coupling regime between atoms and between the molecules and light, like kind of a nanophotonic style. That's a different way, but hard way. But that's an idea, because people have observed that you can put atoms in an optical cavity in a strong coupling regime, and you can modify spontaneous emission rate as much as they want to. So the thing is, if something is messing up with your spontaneous emission rate, then you put it in an optical cavity with the right thing, and then the guy can stay forever. Or you can make it super fast decay. But, of course, usually those experiments are made in nanoscale, of course. So the thing is, that will work for something like 1 meter size. Of course, that's the thing. That's maybe another crazy possibility that we are thinking on, using couplings and stuff like that. And we have this, and they have the other result for the 1 over Q square. You like that for the other form factor. Look kind of nice, I guess. So we are sensitive to nice range, and we can cover 3 orders of magnitude with this setup. And we hope that can work. So with that, this is the idea of REMPY. This is an example of REMPY for H2. In H2, you need 3 photons. H2 is always bad. And you need it.
And here it's hard to get the resolution of that extra photon to be good enough to only start from your excited state.
The guys that made this experiment, they're pretty good. I mean,
right.
The guys that did that, it is hard. H2 is very hard.
Even if your photon is super precise, you're going to hit a fundamental limit. This is. Yeah, with just the REMPY, because there's a line to that guy on stage.
Yeah. But if there was a way to just, you know, I mean, one general idea is all you're doing is trying to add in energy so things become detectable. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of Uber idea here. Right? Mm-hmm. And then if, you know, what if you just added one EV, or, is it always like that? Or can you ever pick off that one excited state?
With this, I think you are going to be, I don't know, think you want to be.
But suppose I only wanted to add half an EV so I could get into a detector where a real detector might be sensitive. Suppose I didn't want to add, you know, that's a lot of energy. You're adding in 12 EV there. That's mm-hmm. a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
Suppose I say I just want to add in half an EV.
Yeah.
Because then when the de-excitation happens, suddenly I have a detector.
Something that is interesting is there's a group in ATH that are working in H2. And they have super precise measurements of H2. Oh. Super, super, but when I say super, it's really super precise. As precise as H, almost like height. And they're using this REMPI scheme. And they have a super high efficiency. The problem, of course, is when I was asking them, OK, what happened if you want to detect a few events in 1 year? And they were like, OK, that's a different thing that we need to think about. But the guys in ETH, they have a very good resolution of this, and the efficiency is almost 100%. So if you have the guy in the equal one state, it's going to be ionized, you detect it.
Okay, this is going a little bit further afield, but if you did use, you know, two molecules, right, and you, one of them, like, you're trying to do something, in some sense, much less gentle than the styrene, mm-hmm. just detect this little bit of energy.
Yeah.
And so, like, the partner molecule could potentially live in an excited state, could, you know, pump it to an excited state,
exactly.
where then
yeah.
a collision
yeah.
would dissociate it, or...
Yeah, but the...
It's like an amplifier. We're just trying to make an amplifier.
But the same frequency that can excite that molecule can excite your molecule. And here, the thing is, we don't want to... I mean, we are looking for less than one bad event in 1 year for 10 to the 23 molecules. Okay, so that's always the problem, because when I do my rebirth thing, 10 to the 9 is awesome, but 10 to the 23 makes things complicated. I noticed that. So that's the thing. So yeah, your idea, it will work perfectly if you have a mod, if you do it in a mod, for sure, it will work. For sure. No doubt. But, and also we were thinking to use molecules in an optical lattice, for instance, because you have super resolution, but you only can have like 8,000, 10,000 at most.
Yeah.
And 10,000 compared with the N23, you have to wait, I don't know, how many age of the universe to see something. So that's the thing. So the systems in AMO that are very precise, they have small number of molecules, and cross-section with time matter is pretty small too, so we need more. So that isn't where we went to. Sorry. What did you guys say? Anyway. Okay, so thank you.
Any more questions? Did you want to hear about the holding rules?
Do you want to tell us about the $100 million?
Yeah, but out of the record.
Out of the record, okay. Can I ask one question? Yes, we'll have a couple of questions on this topic first.
So for the same exposure, the reach is very similar to like Sensei or something. Right, if you have a gram, just if you just count events, like the, you know, the free event limit looks pretty similar.
This is nuclear coupling, so if you actually have a dog photon model, this is not better.
This is nuclear coupling.
Hmm.
Okay.
We're doing scattering with nuclei.
Okay.
Not with the electrons. Electrons here, we don't.
There's like a mu I e squared or mu I n squared difference, just the reduced mass.
Okay, so the advantage of this is that you get access to the nuclear coupling in the same mass range. Okay. Is it obvious why you can't couple to the electrons directly?
Yeah, you could. So, I mean, we think a little bit about using electron states of these things. I mean, you could have other channels as well at the same time. But the goal was to really go for nuclear coupling just because it's harder.
Good.
I mean, there's good ideas like you guys want to make some of them.
Yeah, because basically the question gets, so what, you know, what's the advantage of going to the gas phase with all these additional complications and everything? I guess the answer is, yeah, there's not much else you can do with nuclear complex. So.
I don't know. Also, I mean, from the liquid experiments, I don't think that they are easier than ours. I think that every experiment that you can come up with the dark matter is too messed up. You know, you have too many things to take. It's hard. So I think that I don't think that ours is harder. It's just we need to face different challenges. That's it.
Well, maybe just like, you know, think of classical plastic scintillator. If you want, of course, the reason always for liquid and solid is to get density.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. You're right.
And then how do you work around that with, let's say, plastic scintillator? Well, it's all these additives. There's a a deviously clever set of additives that no one tells you about until you look at a, you know, you have to make your own to make liquid scintillator work. Okay, or like, you know, we use liquid scintillator in LZ, and it's it, that that is for the outer detector, and it's surprising how subtle. But it got all developed since between 1940 and 1970, so we forget about it. We think it's easy. But actually, the development was pretty easy, amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
So here, there's this. That's the other. Is there some trick that can evade the collisional of the excitations? Mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah, so that's what we are looking for, and we are trying to find a way and try to convince some experimentalists to try, like in a small scale, and see if it works.
Well, I don't know, a nice clear liquid, if there was a way to do optical excitation, mm-hmm. you know, and then you got to figure out how to get the energy out, right? Once you get the energy in, you got to get it out. You got to start somewhere, though.
Always in liquids, I get confused. Everything is so hard. In liquids, it's too hard.
Liquid and solid scintillators do work, and they figured out a way to get photons out. You know, mm-hmm. The excitations are there, and they want to be self-absorbed. That's what you...
Yeah.
They don't want to get out, and then you put additives in that get them out. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that it works at all.
I mean, one idea we had was to use gallium arsenide as a scintillator mm-hmm. when darkness comes with electrons, though.
Yeah.
Slice across the band gap, and instead of getting multiple ionization, you just get the photon out.
Yeah.
So Steve DiRenzo at LBL has done a lot of, well, has done some measurements on gallium arsenide as a scintillator, doped with silicon and boron, and it works pretty well.
Oh, okay.
So that's so if one had photodetectors again,
yeah,
that would be a great other applications. You use gallium arsenide as a target, which is a solid, of course, right?
So you get the density somehow. Yeah.
And they, the photon is high energy, that's 1.5, which is quite easier.
Yeah.
But again, they really photodetectors that could do that. And here, potentially, we've got the coincidence of 2, 3, 4 photons, which helps with the dark clouds. But the gallium arsenide, you don't have that. It's okay, good. Other questions? Okay, so you were. So you want to tell us briefly about this?
Well, yeah, I read.
How do we go for it? Okay, first, thank you.
So, yeah, if you just take that and throw it somewhere, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
So as context for people who were here yesterday, so in the course of Ruben's discussion of APEX, we talked a little bit about the new Berkeley AMO measurement of alpha, which claims to do a lot of things. And so we thought we'd ask this is for a little insight.
I just read it very fast and have time was fighting with other issues. But something that I noticed, the guy that wrote this paper was a postdoctoral student of Stephen Chu, Nobel Prize in Physics for optical cooling of atoms. So that's something to think there, okay? Because that guy is pretty smart. I mean, that every work of Stephen Chu is like super solid, like this is the way. You know, it's a guy that doesn't make mistakes. Well, maybe he does, but. It's so I trust that. So here the paper, you see, maybe. Can you read it? Okay, so this is the paper that this guy, you know, I found that he was a student or postdoc with Stephen Chu. So what he does, from what I can learn, they use this kind of 10 photon thing. So this is something that I don't understand. This is something that will help me.
So, I mean, the takeaway is they disagree with the standard model prediction and whatever.
Yeah. But it seems that they're going to the wrong direction, well, to the negative direction, right? Instead to the positive direction. So they are saying that dark photons cannot exist. So that's the thing that why
we're going to even talk about interpretation.
Just the measurement itself.
Yeah.
Well, and which one is the standard model? Which one's standard model?
It's zero. The line is zero is standard model. So this is the five-loop calculation is the denominator, right?
And is the inset? That little inset
is a zoom in on the last two.
Zoom points. In, and so I'm trying to count sigmas from zero. So I count 1.8 sigmas.
I think it's 2.5.
Okay. So they say in the text it's 2.5. So.
Okay. So I found the video of rubidium that Ruben showed me, and there is a very special cesium. the same guys. And also I found like these guys are working this kind of technique in the last 5 years or so. So they have several PRLs. I don't know them. I just figured out that I'm not used.
Sorry, how is alpha measured?
Okay, so what they do?
Fancy atomic matter wave.
Yeah. So here is the thing, how they do it. So in principle, that's something impressive I have to say about these guys. They have a cold gas of cesium. And I say cold is 7 Kelvin or so. This is the temperature they use. And the thing is they have the gas, they drop it, right? So in principle, you are going through the gravity. And then they shine a laser that is resonant with one of the side states of your cesium atom. So then what happens is, if you are resonant, you absorb a photon, then you emit a photon, right? So then what happens is, only the guys that are in the right state are going to get the kick, and then you split the guys. So like some of the atoms are going to be up, and others keep going down, okay? So they are separated. Then here, they apply, again, another laser. And again, more separated again. These guys keep horizontal, this keep going up. But here is the nice thing that they introduced, but they were not the first, by the way. They call the bulk oscillation. So what they have here, I don't know how the hell they can do this. They put an optical lattice. Do you know what is an optical lattice? What they do is, this is something that people use, but not at these temperatures. Usually they use it at very colder temperatures, like 100 nanokelvins or so. So I don't know how they manage, but this is what they say. So what happens if you have atoms, right? You see a laser, the atoms can absorb one direction, and mean in a random direction, whatever. But if you have a mirror, what happens is you form a thin wave. That thin wave gives you maximum and minimum of the potential. So then the atoms like to place in the minimum. Where the positions are depends on the wavelength of the laser. So if you move, if you change the frequency of the laser, you are moving the atoms. And this is what these guys use here to give an extra kick. And they claim that using these two techniques, between the first photon kicks and this what they call block oscillation technique, you can control the effect between one and another. So in the sense that you don't have any error or mess up coming from there. And then this between two, and they measure the interference. So they observe what is the phase, and we have something like, well, this is that the result isn't so. They have the result. There's another paper that I found that is there. From the same guys. Here. I like this paper a lot. So this is the paper about the Rubin people, French group. And the idea is the same. They use the same thing. But the difference between the new guys and these guys is they absorb, in the new ones, they absorb 10 photons. In the old ones, they absorb 2 photons. Only thing that changed. Same setup. And the atom, of course. They use rubidium, right? So then this is the way how they calculate alpha. So you know what is the mass, you calculate all the stuff. You know this very well. They have here. Mass of the electron is known. The Rebbe constant is, well, not 7 times 10 to the minus 12. So then they use all that stuff for interference, and then they can get what is alpha. That's how they do the interference. Because all this data here comes into the phase sheet. So what they do, the interference. So the thing is, you have the atomic cloud, you separate them, to photon kicks, then you put it together, and they have interference, right? And then as a function of the kick that you are giving them, you have a shift. And with that shift, they can measure, okay, they can give you what is this ratio here, and alpha.
Sorry, what does absorbing 2 photons versus 10 photons mean?
So what it means is how much you separate them. It's like how much kinetic energy are you giving.
Okay, so the more the better if you can control the systematics.
Yeah, okay. That's what these guys are claiming. That is why this is a science, it's to be a PRL, I guess.
But the energy levels are not harmonically spaced, right? So
multiple
lasers to do that?
No, but these guys, they always have like a two-level system. So they only care about the gun state and the first electronic state. That's it. So you have a laser that is resonant with this guy, you absorb the photon, then you get the kick, then you emit the photon, then you have 1 photon, 2 photon, 3 photon, 4 photons. So the thing is, they apply the laser at a given time to be sure that they absorb 10 photons. In the other guys, they use a Raman thing. So in the Raman thing, what they do is something like they go to a continuum state and then they go to the heap. So you have a two laser, you transfer from the continuum to the other one. That's what they do. And then you have a kick of the momentum given by the energy spacing.
Can you show us the relation, the formula where they used to extract alpha again? They had some relationship between the
equation. Yeah. Yes, see, I found it. Okay. They are using the two hyperfine states of the medium. Some of them. Then the ratio can be eliminated by this guy here. And if you have this guy here, then you can go to the equation
for three.
Yeah, you go to equation two and you have everything.
So they're measuring precisely the difference between two levels, and that's what the sensitivity to alpha is.
So what they have in my view, again, I didn't do the experiment, I would like to know better. But by my view, what they are saying is like when you separate these clouds, they collide, the phase shift that they change, I mean, the phase that you see in the interferometer depends on the kinetic energy, right? So that kinetic energy depends on the mass of the particles and the h bar, right? Because h bar is related with the energy that you're giving, and the mass is the in inertia, right? So then you have a kind of fundamental way to get that ratio. Once you have that ratio, you know how alpha relates with that, to this equation.
So you're actually just measuring h bar.
Yeah, so they're measuring the ratio.
Unless you're measuring something.
They're measuring the ratio between h bar and the mass of the rubidium. That's what they do.
But that's not directly alpha.
Yeah, well, yeah, so you are thinking that they have a way to get alpha directly? No, they don't.
But if you tell me that it depends on an energy level difference, that depends on alpha. But the first equation confused me because there wasn't anything that depended on alpha.
The Rydberg constants probably.
Yeah, they are the constant. This is the Rydberg constant.
So are they measuring the Rydberg?
They're measuring the mass of the rubidium, I think.
They're measuring the ratio. This guy. You know, I think they measure
the ratio.
And this is
the
supposed
to be a
Rydberg constant.
It's a mass of the rubidium.
So the thing is, this is supposed to be very well known. As we can see here, they claim with a pretty high precision.
That's R infinity, and then it's MRV over ME is 10 minus 10. Because, yeah, I wonder, who knows the mass of rubidium atom to high accuracy? But I guess somebody does.
So the reason why they are getting these kind of...
No, because they measure H over MRV.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know...
Right, so you have to know MRV over a converted to alpha.
And the mass are known with certain.
So they say
that they know with that. I know.
Well, for R infinity, that's R infinity. But
yeah.
The worst known quantity is MRV over ME. That's 4.4 times MS.
Yes.
And then I just wonder, you know, what isotope for rubidium. I guess, you know, these are the usual questions. How do you really get that really right? You know?
So the thing that the guys in science did is the same but with cesium.
Yeah.
And if you have a 2-photon key, they have a 10-photon key. And then they have a better estimation of this ratio and that kind of stuff, and they can get a better alpha.
But it's also not a direct measurement of alpha, it's not a direct H-bar.
There's not like a alpha meter.
Okay.
I don't think that there is nothing like that. So usually in atomic physics, it's very weird to have a rigid way to see something. You always have to use something that you know very well to get
sort of bootstrap.
Yeah, it's like in the whole thing and that kind of stuff, right? You know something and then use that to get something else. So that's how we do things. But you always have something for you.
When they say it's a trip for the standard model, right, they're basically taking the G minus 2 measurement of alpha and comparing
with
that. Right?
Yeah.
And
so,
so when he thinks about possible systematics on this, I mean, I don't know, maybe some other people have.
Yeah, here they have a table of all the systematics.
Okay.
And there's some experimental that maybe they can see some of the state. Don't see if there is any. They're taking it along.
The gooey phase, I like that one. Whatever that is.
So, what's the interpretation of alpha being different from standard models?
It's that photons are screwed.
Right, and the force law is modified because. There's a contribution from a non.
They have these plots that you guys know.
That non-standard model.
These kind of plots.
I guess that's what somebody's saying here.
Which was the mass of the? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The right button, so the pseudoscalar, which gives the right sign.
Not a pseudoscalar, a vector, axial vector.
Sorry, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, which measurement is the new physics affecting in this equation?
I mean, is it G minus 2 or is it?
G minus 2, okay. And it's G minus 2 of the electron.
Of the electron, yeah. So you use the G minus 2 of the electron measurement to define alpha. So then you need to sort of use the second best measurement of alpha to actually get it respecting physics. And that's the second best measurement, I think.
What's the second best measurement?
This
well, it's not a direct measurement of alpha.
Well, there's a third point. So yeah, maybe we can mess with something else as well.
That's yeah, it's not the big. But the claim is that the dark photon's contributing to the G minus 2 of the electron.
Exactly.
And the rest of this is just the metrology.
And it contributes, so the dark photon contributes to the opposite side, unlike the G minus 2 of the muon, where it contributes to the correct side to solve the discrepancy.
So is this bound interesting compared to other bounds that people know about?
It is, yeah. So it's a stronger, I mean, sort of it's been inching down, so you can see on the left side, that's the dark photon. So that's, they say this work. Mm-hmm. So the way they did the statistics here was a bit suspect. They sort of said, right, so if you add any dark photon of any epsilon arbitrarily small, it's going to make the discrepancy worse. So they were saying that at 99.something%, it's all dark photons of any epsilon in mass are excluded. But that's of course silly, like you're not sensitive to some ultra large epsilon, so they should use some CLS mechanism. Anyway, whatever. So this is roughly what the bound is on the left. On the other hand, if you have pseudo an axial vector, then you could, that has the right side. So on the right side of the plot, they have this, I guess the white region is favored in that sense by the G minus 2 of the electron measurement.
But on the other hand, because that plot comes from my paper, I can say that. Okay. So that plot is like, if you didn't have any UV constraints on your model and you just wanted to write down an exocoupling of allergies. And then we spent 10 pages showing that it's just wildly inconsistent with all the other precision measurements, especially parity violating atomic scattering. And so once you take that plot with an enormous grain of salt, it's extremely hard to build a model that gives you axial couplings at low energies and doesn't conflict with anything else. We could not, in fact, find one that worked. Even if you like tried to put in new Kalman couplings for each fermion, each generation by hand, you still couldn't make it work. So I think one should take this discrepancy with a grain of salt and not as evidence for new physics and axial couplings, but...
So what's, maybe some other people know, how much do we trust the G minus 2 of the electron calculation? Is there any way that could be wrong?
There's no group that's cross-checking this, right? It's just like the one guy's group, and then they find the sign mistake every 5 years, and...
Yeah. I mean, what's the chance of that?
I think at this point there's actually multiple groups I heard. I don't know.
Here, they describe something. Yeah, well, this... different things, so they are drawn even the weak and not the best measurement coming from this paper. I think that there's a 30 paper they come up.
So what's the state of the art? It's five loops?
Five loops.
Yeah, five loops.
I think it's five loops complete. That's it used to be in some approximation, but now it's just straight up all diagrams, five loops.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering what the most likely explanation is for the discrepancy. I mean, maybe it's just statistics. Yeah, just whatever happens.
I think that from the technique that they are using is quite confident. I mean, I don't see.
No, not just the experimental, I guess. So they maybe stick to the standard model.
Well, I don't know. It's something is a number that you get, another thing is the interpretation that you make with that number, right? That's a more human thing.
Sorry, what's the estimated uncertainty on the five loop calculation? How's it compared to this, two sigma?
Here.
No? Is it significant or insignificant?
Yeah, I mean, they have a plot. So you go up to the first page, or of the science paper. Yeah. So there's an error bar on the standard model, right?
It's a theory error.
Or sorry, is there or no?
No, it's not supposed to be zero.
So no, he's asking what's the error on?
It's 10 to that. So it was about 0.37 parts per billion, and this is in. Billions, right? So 0.37 on that plot, which is...
0.37?
Oh, actually, that's not bad, right? So that gets you pretty close to agreement. Sorry. Yeah, sorry.
0.37?
But right. So that's the going here. That's pretty much the standard model theory prediction. So actually, they're not that disagreement. Is that taken into account?
So you're not just describing the red error bar.
There's the experimental error and then the theory error is comparable to the experimental error. So I think those both included.
They
in
might have.
Well, presumably, if you're plotting alpha, it should be.
Well, so the theory experiment in that case.
The theory's in that.
That's the question.
Well, you took
No, I know that's a question I asked, but I thought.
I don't. I mean, I think the theory of plural will be smaller than the theory error.
They look comparable, right? Experimental and theoretical error, that's what these are the same.
Okay. Second is the theoretical one, second, yeah.
That presumably there's a gap.
But that doesn't include systematics like mistakes.
Yeah, that's something that is funny. I have to say is all the people I have seen in the atomic physics working about alpha, they are all in PRL, except this one.
Well,
yes. No, something to think about. Something funny about it.
No, but I think it's actually important because, like, for example, what this meant is that this bypassed the archive. And so the paper actually never went in front of high-energy people who could have been like, well, maybe one shouldn't be so confident about ruling out all new physics.
Maybe you should write an argument.
No, but people have. People who are more senior than me have
made this point. Yeah, because otherwise...
Yeah, no, they've gotten you wrong.
Okay.
I would dig into the mass of the Rubidium. Something bothers me about that. I can't explain what it is, but that's the other term that just as they sort of state it, and they're doing mass spectroscopy of rubidium to a part of 10 to the 10th, which maybe that could be done, but it's pretty hard.
Where's that ratio come from?
It must be mass spectrometry. How do you measure atomic masses in high accuracy with mass spectrometry?
The paper that enumerates the fiction, can we look at the size of the hadronic light by light? I'm just curious.
Oh, I think that's tiny.
Even if it's sub-reading the size of the error, so there's so they must say what that is somewhere, this ahadronic, which is up somewhere in the paper, I think. Maybe if you go up in the paper, they'll say what ahadronic is. Oh, okay, not in this paper.
As a fractional, that's parametrically smaller than the muons, because the muon mass is close to the hadronic scale.
Yes, of course. But I mean, once we're in parts per billion, right?
Here is something funny. This is supplemental information of the paper, like 25 pages. This is something that they compared to the theories. Other you notice this one.
Oh, yeah.
So you were asking about
that's the hadron.
There's the hadron mass.
Yeah. So
that's the comparison. The comparison.
Yeah. So it's larger than the 5-loop contribution?
Larger than it seems to exceed.
What is the light by
the way? The hadronic. Yeah.
Well, it's sorry, like they don't show the, it is larger than the 5. Yeah. It's obviously, wait.
Is this supplemental?
It's 4-loop.
Yeah, this is the supplemental information for
the 5, right? Alpha to the 4th, that's the 4-loop calculation.
Yeah, so it's smaller, it's bigger than 5.
Bigger than 5. I think that's the 5-loop. There's a contribution.
Yes.
It's not just a hadronic vacuum.
Right, but the light by light, at least in the muon, is much smaller than that.
Than the overall. Okay, so you're saying light by light is just smaller.
Yeah, I think so.
The largest hadronic thing is the pion pool. Sometimes they take that out and treat the light by light as a separate.
So the people that are trying to do like the one unified theory prediction for geodesy with the muon, is that going to help improve? Because presumably if all you care about is the lattice part, then whatever Fermi you attach to the end doesn't really matter. So that would presumably help nail this down, right?
The lattice people just measure as an effect of an operator. So I think
Well, thanks very much for enlightening us.
Yeah, let's wrap it up, I think. So let's first thank Jesus again.